Well, all right then. Hi, and glad you're listening. Welcome to American Hit Radio. Every Wednesday and Friday here on WHPC 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. Heidi Morales Ryan, my lovely wife, trying to figure out what the heck you're doing over there. You got a screw loose, yeah. But the whole microphone fell apart?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
I'm going to try and fix it while I'm talking on the other mic.
Look at okay, this is like quite the ordeal. It's a good thing you're physically fit. You can manage to do all those things together.
I'm multitasking.
Okay, I'll keep talking while you work then. Okay. It won't be that much different
than
most.
It's not any different than
any other day, really. What is a little bit different is I want to focus on something other than 1973. I want to go forward a decade and look at what was happening 30 years ago in the spring of 1983 for today's show. I'm looking at album tracks rather than singles. Gives me a little bit more room to stretch out. Looking at the songs around this, it got me to thinking about how music had progressed and having lived through it, that we kind of didn't really notice what was happening. But I remember like being around when punk hit, and punk was really supposed to have changed the music industry drastically by getting basically kicking all the old heavy, ponderous...
The geezers.
Yeah, with all of their, you know, conceptual, complicated arrangements and overproduction, and kick all that stuff to the curb and make rock and roll fresh and new and vital again. You know, basically three chords in an attitude one more time, you know? And it lasted for a while, but of course, punk ended up leading to post-punk. And post-punk eventually got merged into this commercial idea of what punk was, so it became new wave. And by 1983, that was dead even. And now we ended up like living in what I guess you could be called like the post-new wave era. And we didn't notice it at the time, but really it's like everything that was old is new again. I mean, we sort of ended up back where we started. Most of the music that was around in 83, although it was all influenced by punk, most of it was melodic. Most of it was highly produced, had exotic instrumentation. It really wasn't that much different from where things were before punk hit. But we kind of didn't notice it. And in fact, we were calling a lot of these bands as bands that basically that sprung out of the punk movement. So I think it's kind of funny when I look at it now. So I'll be keeping that in mind as we play our way through a few of these albums. Some of them just going to feature with a single track, maybe two. And others I'll focus on a little bit more. The first one is one that I want to focus on a bit more because I don't think it gets much airplay at all. And I think it's a great album. I know you're a big fan of Echo and the Bunnymen, Heidi.
Definitely.
And in 1983, they had released their third album. This was the album Porcupine. After the first album, they put out Heaven Up Here, which was good, but it was a bit ponderous and heavy. It seemed like it was the typical second album syndrome thing that a lot of bands go through, where they use up all their really commercial
material
on the first record. And then they're trying to basically recreate it, and the second record seems to be a bit, you know, not quite up to snuff. But they bounced back great with the third album, Porcupine. As usual, the lead singer, Ian McCulloch, is incredibly self-indulgent in terms of his styling. It's nowhere near what we were, like last week when we were playing Brian Ferry and Roxy. He doesn't go near that sort of craziness.
Yeah.
But he is a little bit histrionic, I think. It's not unfair to say that. There's almost like a cry in every line that he sings. But again, I mean, you know, but the guitar riffs are fantastic. These songs are all very melodic. I mean, really strong melodies to support these songs, intriguing words, and very unpunk-like in a lot of ways. Like I said, this could have maybe happened even if punk never happened. And yet, if you were going to ask this band their roots, I'm sure that that's what they would say.
Of course.
That they came from the punk movement. So let's play a couple of tracks from this album, starting with the song that was sort of the hit single from the album called Porcupine. The song is entitled The Cutter.
Cutter, who's on the seventh floor, brewing no turning.
Now, you see, it's funny because we're just discussing this as the song is playing. I mean, you're thinking about how punk rock was allegedly changing the world, but and that sounds nothing at all like a punk rock band to me. Not even close. I mean, there's strings all over it. I mean, lots of them.
Yeah.
It's an amazingly, you know, arranged song. It was, you know, he's basically bringing back romance, in a sense, to punk rock, which, again, made it less punk. And I mean, if it wasn't for the way that things happened to fall in the scope of history, I would say that this music has absolutely nothing to do with that type of music. You know, I'm not saying that it's bad. I love it. I you know, at that time, Echo and the Bunnymen were one of my favorite bands because I just loved. I mean, when they had hits like the last song, the melodies were great. You'd love to hear their stuff in clubs because it was it just sounded like it, a lot of good, hard work went into it. And it's well written songs. And their albums, generally speaking, had it wasn't like they had the one hit and then the rest of the album was filler. There are a few albums today that we could discuss that. Yeah, I mean, for the most part, a lot of the songs were good. In fact, let's play another track that was from this album. I think this is also was released maybe as a 12-inch single from the record. I'm not positive of that. I remember it got a little bit of airplay on college radio. Not much more outside of that, though. Again, from the same album called Porcupine. The name of this track is The Back of Love.
I'm on the chopping block, chopping up my stopping thoughts. Self-doubt and selfism were the cheapest things I ever bought. You sent love to win the back of love. Easier said than done. You
private place, I would stare you into the ground. That's how I articulate the value of my face, the value of my face.
And the Bunnymen from their third album. They went on to make a couple of other albums after this that were also quite great. And then, I don't know, man, they like just literally, it's almost like they fell off of a cliff or something. They just got bad so fast.
Love will do that to you sometimes.
Was that what it was? I don't even know what caused
like sugar
it.
Kisses?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Exactly. That was where it got painful.
Yeah.
And I really loved them up until that point. I mean, the album just
before
that was...
Yeah, I blame it on Fallen in Love.
It could be. Could be.
You'll never write an album, hon. Put it to you that way.
Probably true. Well, we just got done playing three tracks from the album Porcupine by Echo and the Bunnymen. Looking at albums that are now 30 years old that came out in the early part of 1983 and started to reach their commercial peak. That was one of them. Another album... was the third album, another third album, actually. This time the band was U2. I'm not going to play a lot from this album because I think that, I think U2 is overexposed.
Yes.
To be honest.
I concur.
I think it's not that I dislike the band. It's just that they've come to represent pretty much everything else that was existing at that time. It's the one band that really seemed to sink in and penetrate into the mainstream culture. And it did so to the disadvantage of everything. For example, you don't hear anything by Echo and the Bunnymen any longer, but you still hear U2 all the time.
Right.
So that's part of it. Now, I don't think that that's because U2's album is particularly better. I'm not exactly sure what the reason is, but nevertheless, it is the case. But when War came out, it was their third album, and it was a similar situation to what happened with Echo and the Bunnymen. The first album came out was... pretty interesting. A good debut album was called Boy. Mm-hmm. Had a bunch of good stuff on it, and they had a unique sound. And then their second album came out called October, and it was the second album syndrome. There really wasn't very much on it that was listenable. It was tedious, actually, and it looked like they very possibly could have become just, you know, a one album, you know, basically one good hit album, and that was it. But again, just like Echo and the Bunnymen, their third album came out and they turned it around again. They sort of capitalized on what they had going on their first album, made it a little bit more interesting. I mean, this is like the album that more or less brought the whole anthemic thing to the forefront.
True.
That's what I want to play. You know, when you think of early U2, it's probably the album War that you're thinking of, because this is the album that had New Year's Day on it and... you know, basically all the big songs that sounded like you could just see Bono on stage, like, waving a flag as he's singing these songs.
I think that's exactly what he did the whole time, right?
I think, yeah, just stomping around in his boots carrying a flag, right? You know, so I just picked one song which I think might not have aged as much as some of the others. Like I said, you know, songs like New Year's Day, like I said, has got, you know, probably a bit overdone. Sunday Bloody Sunday is another one from that record that gets airplay all the time. You don't hear this one quite as much, though, so maybe it's still got a little bit of life in it then. From the album War, here's U2 with Two Hearts Beat as One. I was not a big U2 fan at the time. It wasn't until
I remember
Octung
when
Baby.
Boy came out. Yeah. And then after that, it got more and more anthemic as
yeah.
it went along. And it just like,
it began
I was
to, like
oh,
become grating.
So not the arena rock type person.
They put out that album Live at Red Rocks, which was a lot of the same material that's on the album War, like this track that we just heard. And it used to crack me up. My way of mocking it at the time was like, oh, all we're going to hear is hear Bono basically scream that one note for every single song. So it's, oh, oh, oh. That's all that he does. Like, for every song, it's just like, oh my God, do you have to do that? If you have melodies, you're basically belting out on this, one note. It really wasn't like he's a great singer. But he really was doing something that was kind of cool. And in retrospect, I think a lot of it had to do with me being like a little bit jealous of the fact that he was getting the recognition that he was, because I was in a band at the time, and we had a thing that we were trying to do that kind of sounded a little bit like them, because we were using an Echoplex. So we had a lot of similar effects to what was happening with The Edge. So I think that a lot of my dislike was really just flat out, basically prejudice and jealousy, rather than like real dislike. Because I think I was like saying, they're good. I just want to admit that they're good. A band that I was into, this is another band that basically really thwarted the whole punk rock thing. Dire Straits went in the exact opposite. Punk hit, and at the same time the punk hit, Dire Straits became famous, which was so weird because they are, again, anything but. They're not even remotely like a punk band. But when they first came out in 78, that's what everything else was on the radio. They were the alternative to punk at that time by playing simple four-piece songs that you could be playing on. That first album, their second album too, was just really simple but really tasteful arrangements of some great songwriting by Mark Knopfler. The third album came out, Making Movies, that everybody loved so much. I thought that that was the opposite. I thought that that was a step backward because it was overproduced. And the song writing wasn't as good as the first two records, in my opinion. And then that started to define a trend because the albums were starting to get more and more ponderous. After Making Movies came Love Over Gold. And Love Over Gold was just, it's hard to even remember it much now because there was just all of these really ponderous, slow songs. I think it's the album that had the 18-minute opening track on it.
Wow.
Telegraph Road. So it was like, oh boy, this is really going back to what rock and roll was like before punk. So I think they were getting some feedback, pushback actually, because of the way that they were getting a little bit too serious. Especially when Love Over Gold wasn't selling as well as the first two albums. So they released an EP soon after that album came out. It was around March of 1983 when the EP came out. And the EP was just fun. Here's this band that seemed like they had no sense of humor at all. And all of a sudden they put out this record that was just pretty much dance music. It was a good time. And most of the songs were upbeat. Some of them are flat out silly. And the EP took its title from the lead-off track, so that's what we'll play. It was a four-song EP, so we want to just cover one song just to cover it, though. But I think this little record really helped Dire Straits with their longevity. The name of the EP was Twisting by the Pool. Here's the title track. Yeah, it's a silly song, but it's a fun song. Definitely a great summer party tune. Whole idea of Twisting by the Pool. What could be bad about that, right? Okay, you were listening to American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM. I am your host, Tom Ryan. Heidi Morales Ryan with me, kind of with me. I'm not sure if she's with me or not. Hello?
Yes, I am with you in spirit, if not in mind.
Okay. Glad you made it. Did I say we're here every Wednesday and Friday? I might have. If you're interested in our show and you want to basically catch up on some of the past shows we've done or some of the history that we've covered, you can go to our website and check it out. Just search for American Hit Radio on your computer, and our website will come up.
We're right there.
Certainly. And you'll see the Wednesday show and the Friday show there. The most recent shows are right there on the homepage, and you can click through to go deep. And you can go really deep. I think we're close. There's well over 500 shows up there now, which amazes me. Getting old doing this. That's better than the alternative, right?
That's right.
Well, we are looking right now at music that came to the forefront of our attention 30 years ago, around March of 1983. How far have we come? One trend that was happening around this point in time, very common one. Don't forget, this is really pre-CD now in 1983. People would release albums, and
That's
the
right.
albums would be accompanied, or not, sometimes just be out on their own, with 12-inch releases. But in the 60s and 70s, really, it was you'd put out albums, you'd put out singles. But after punk, for some reason, the 12-inch vinyl record became really, really popular. I mean, what do you call it? The extended play? You'd play it at 45 instead of 33, and
right.
there would be like one song on a side, on each side. So they would take a track, or they would stretch. They maybe take a 4-minute track and stretch it out to 6 minutes, or 8 minutes, or 12 minutes. Sometimes, some of them were incredibly boring. Others were really good, but if you were it was always a disappointment if you had the album and then you saw the 12-inch. You say, "Oh, good, a different, there it is, new stuff," and you'd get it. You just see they took the same song and they just you get some DJ to basically roll it on
some,
about
instrumental.
Yeah,
junk.
They dub on about 4 or 5 extra minutes of miscellaneous
Xylophone.
Crap and stuff that you don't need. Speaking of which, it's exactly the track I'm thinking of right now. I don't know if you know where I'm going with this.
I'm not sure,
but Matt Johnson had that album called Soul Mining. He put it out with his, the band name, The.
The, yes.
Right. Soul Mining came out, and it wasn't a particularly impressive album. And it had a version of this one track on it. And the version on the, this is what was an unusual example, because usually the album version is the definitive version, and the 12-inch expands on it.
Right.
In this instance, the album version was the wrong version. It really just wasn't very good. But the 12-inch version, although it was longer, just really had that cool riff with that crazy xylophone beat thing that was in there. It's funny to mention that just out of the blue. And a pretty decent guitar riff. So let's play, I think I've got the 12-inch version queued up, of the track Uncertain Smile by Matt Johnson, a.k.a. The.
Swim and call you out. sometimes pour orange-colored shapes through your windows. A broken soul stares from a pair of watering eyes. Uncertain emotions force an uncertain smile. You under my skin where the rain can get in. But if the sweat pours out, just shout. I'll try to swim and pull you out.
This is a good example of what I was talking about with the 12-inch version, where it basically, I'm realizing this is not the version that I was even looking for. This is one of the problems with music from around this era, because there's the album version, which you can still always get on the album, but there were numerous 12-inch versions of the track, all of them different. The one that I remember is the one that featured a flute as the main instrument, as the riff. The flute isn't even in that version.
Oh, no, I remember this one. This is definitely the one I remember.
The one that just played? Really?
Yep.
I think of the one with the flute as being the one that I recall the best, which is right there, at least three. And I bet you there were four completely distinct versions of that song. But that's what you'd have to contend with that in 1983. You know, you'd go out, you'd say, oh, I want that song. You'd buy the album. You realize, oh, this isn't the version I wanted.
Right.
Then you'd have
then
to like buy the
stuck with it.
Right. Then you'd buy the 12-inch and say, well, this isn't the version either. There's another, you know, you wouldn't know. I remember that happening with Elvis Costello. It drove me crazy right around this exact point in time, in fact. The album called Punch the Clock. He'd put out three different 12-inch mixes.
You were about to punch his clock.
Really? Oh, God, you know, I bought the album. Now I got to buy three different 12-inch singles, you know, to get every version of the song that you released. And if you're a completist, you end up doing things like that.
Like somebody in the room whom shall remain nameless.
Makes people nuts. One person who was making, who I just discovered in 1980, put out his first album, his debut album, came out in Great Britain earlier than this. It wasn't until March of 1983 when Thomas Dolby's debut album was released in America. I had known it from the import, and I loved it. So when by the time it came out in America, they had added a few tracks to it. You know, he was already on MTV, and She Blinded Me with Science was huge.
Right.
One of his big songs. Now, that song was not on the original album, but in for the American market, they added that. I mean, everybody knows him for that and One of Our Submarines. Both really, really excellent songs, but they were the 12-inch release. They were tracks from the 12-inch single that I'm talking about. In America, they basically, they eventually put them onto the album. But the album itself, which was called The Golden Age of Wireless, was a really cool piece of work. It had some really interesting music on it that the American market never really got to know. So I'd like to play at least two tracks from that album that I think are both excellent. The first one, you almost never hear on the radio. Kind of, I don't know, this was, I always considered this to be a great late night driving song. By Thomas Dolby. The name of this track is Weightless.
Some nights he's weightless, he has to travel. His mouth is gravel, and there's an empty feeling within his heart. Eye on the fuel gauge, Westchester through it, that triple octane won't contain the empty feeling. Same old insecurity, strap him into his car seat, and a song started the game all over New Jersey. Gas stations everywhere, not one drop to fill me. Of carrot cake, blueberry milkshake, fistful of cold dress, won't fix the empty feeling in Lizzie's heart. So she flick on the TV, taking a movie, but all those memories wanna raise the empty. Dog walk inside of her to watch the explosion, and a pipe started leaking, and she bent to the basin. Fruit juice everywhere, not one drop to fill me.
learned to swim, and the feeling is gone again.
Is that's of course Thomas Dolby, maybe not of course, but that's who it is.
That is who it is, of course.
The album was entitled The Golden Age of Wireless. That track was entitled Europa and the Pirate Twins. That's Andy Partridge of XTC on harmonica on
that
track. Weightless was the name of the track before that. The thing that I liked about the Thomas Dolby album, now, as you know, I'm not a big fan of synthesizers, but this is the way music was going in 83.
Right.
Everything was, there was an awful lot of synthetic music. And some of it was just really bad. I mean, I'm just not a, so many of the duo bands, they were just really dumb, simplistic. You know, that's all that they would do. There was nothing more to it. But Thomas Dolby was, it sounded like he had a sort of a genius knack for it. The rhythms are kind of, are unique and interesting. There's there's syncopation going on, interesting
right.
sounds that he's it's not just the same sound being repeated. Like, it's not Human League dopiness. Because you know how much I despise that band.
Yes, I do.
And if you listen to like a track like, you know, like their stuff compared to Thomas Dolby's, I mean, Thomas Dolby was infinitely more sophisticated. So I kind of liked it for that reason. It was putting me out of work as a drummer. It kind of made me sound irrelevant. But it's the way that it was.
Oh, well, things come around.
Yep, this certainly did. And we almost stayed up another hour, so we may as well start getting ready to say goodbye. I'll introduce another album, and then we'll go.
Okay.
We'll play this out until the end of the show. Van Morrison is the one artist I'm playing here who basically predated punk, obviously. Survived it by basically ignoring it, remaining true to himself all the while. By 1983, there were some concessions being made to production styles. He was starting to use an awful lot of electronic keyboards on his stuff. But it was in March of 83 that he released an album that was one of the most spacious and spiritual. All of his records sound spiritual. But this was just so mellow. And I thought it was quite beautiful. At this point in time, I have to say that the album is pretty much a footnote. Maybe completely forgotten. People don't remember that. Sadly. Van Morrison released an album called Inarticulate Speech of the Heart. But it was, I thought it was a beautiful album. At that point in time, it was one of my favorite albums of his. And when I hear it now, I still like it. Maybe it's because there's a Celtic feel to it through perhaps all of the production that's there. So we'll play a couple of tracks from this album till the end of our hour. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. And we'll see you as we return on Friday with How Music Changed. Meanwhile, from Inarticulate Speech of the Heart, here's a track called Higher Than the World.
Get better than it seems today. I'm now higher than clouds, and I'm living in sound. I'll make it better than it seems today. Head is in a swirl. I gotta give a laugh a word today. Higher than the clouds, wrapped up in the sound. I'll be getting better.
I'll be waiting.